Good morning, I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Wednesday, December 30th. I've got 10 degrees here in Old Town Park City. Some blue sky, and on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, Adam Carroll. Good morning, Adam.
Good morning. Yeah, we've got some blue skies to start the day, but we will see increasing clouds as we head into the afternoon. And by that point, we're likely just looking at mostly cloudy skies as we've got a disturbance that will come in here overnight into early tomorrow morning that will bring some light snow showers in after a 28-degree high temperature today. And we also are dealing with a little bit of fog and low clouds in the Wasatch back, and especially the Heber Valley here this morning as well. So you might have some visibility and some slightly slick roads to deal with if you're out in the Heber Valley, Midway Valley this morning as well. But, you know, we'll stay in the single digits for the next several mornings. We'll be in and around the upper 20s to low 30s here as well for the next several days. But that light snow that comes in tomorrow could bring an inch or two to our resorts in the area, but not a whole lot else, even in actual Park City proper. This just isn't a huge storm, and it's very, very weak with not a lot of moisture with it. But, you know, anything's good. And then we have a couple of quiet days, Friday and Saturday. And then we get into active storm track here beginning Sunday with snow every day beginning later Sunday all the way through the week. With temperatures in the low to mid-30s all week long and the potential right now for a significant storm next Thursday. But, you know, this is great news because it's about time we get into this type of a pattern for our mountains that desperately need that snow as well as our valleys. But that's something to look forward to as we head into the first week of January.
Yeah, we've been really patient. Thank you, Adam.
You bet. Thank you.
KPCW News Time now, 8:08. And with a look in the backcountry and the fun with us from the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center, it's Trent. Good morning, Trent.
Hey, good morning, everyone. Looking out there in the backcountry right now, you know, as you just heard, we'll have plenty of sunshine today. We will remain under a cold northwest flow, so those winds will be out of the northwest, keeping the temperatures pretty cool. Most of the weather stations were reporting the single digits to low teens Fahrenheit pretty much across the map out there. Winds up upper elevation winds like along the Park City ridgeline, they're blowing 5 to 15 miles per hour and gusting into the low 20s. It will be a wonderful day. Temperatures will warm into the mid to low 20s up there in the mountains today. As you just heard, yeah, we do have some snow for next week. Not much accumulation between now and then, but we're really crossing our fingers. Like you said, we need that snow in the mountains, we need that water. If we do get that snow and we do get that water, you could expect much different avalanche conditions next week, and the danger will rise significantly. But we'll deal with that when we get down the road here, maybe Sunday into Monday. Yesterday, there was no new avalanches reported from the backcountry. However, cracking and loud audible collapses continue to be reported by many observers, and those loud audible collapses are actually where somebody's just walking through a meadow or riding through a meadow and the entire snowpack collapses underneath them. A lot of times it lets out a big booming sound. We call it a woomph noise. And basically they've triggered an avalanche. What they're missing is a steep enough slope for the snow to slide on. So with that being said, you know, we're still recommending people avoid steep northerly facing terrain. So it's really any of the terrain that's been shaded. That's where you're going to find a weak layer of snow with a stronger slab of snow on top. And you'll find a considerable avalanche danger there, and human triggered avalanches are still likely. Across the mid elevation terrain, so, you know, we just drop off the Park City ridgeline just a little bit in elevation. We have a moderate danger for human-triggered avalanches, and avalanches remain possible in that type of terrain. And one thing to remember with these weak layers is don't fool yourself into thinking that the slope is safe because you see tracks, right? Tracks are not a sign of stability. And what we know about instability is that recent avalanches, poor snowpack structure, and collapsing of the snowpack are always the trump cards. So really our best strategy is to continue avoiding steep avalanche terrain altogether right now. Unfortunately, we're we were dealt a bad hand this winter. We have weak snow on the ground, and therefore the only thing we can really do is rein in our terrain selection. So meaning we really need to just stick to slopes under 30 degrees in steepness, not be traveling underneath anything steep or, you know, adjacent to steep slopes, as avalanches can be triggered remotely, meaning from a distance. You know, you collapse that slope you're standing on and that crack travels through the snowpack up to the steeper terrain, and that's where the avalanche can come down. So that's generally what we're looking at out there. There was a very large avalanche out in the Uintas that was reported yesterday. It was a natural avalanche, but it was breaking 2 to 3 feet deep and 1,000 feet wide. So if you're, you know, on a snow machine or a snowmobile, make sure to check the Uinta forecast, or if you're heading out there to ride, really important because conditions are a little bit different out there in the Uintas.
Okay, Trent, thank you.
Thank you.
Stay tuned. Coming up on the local news hour this morning, I'll be checking in with retiring Summit County Council member Kim Carson. Summit County Health Department Nursing Director Derek Moss will be on with People's Health Clinic Executive Director Beth Armstrong with details about the Medical Health Corps rollout of the vaccine. And then finally, the National Development Team Director of EduStaff, Raymond Massey, talks about the new staffing contract to provide substitute teachers and other staff for the Park City School District. Stay tuned. And also stay tuned for the Mountain Life right after the local news hour. Today's guests include Dr. Wieg Province, Medical Director at Intermountain Park City Hospital, giving an update on the COVID numbers in Summit County and the importance of staying safe until you get to the vaccine. Then best-selling health and science journalist Gary Taubes, who has written such books as The Case Against Sugar and Why We Get Fat, talks about his new book called The Case for Keto, Rethinking Weight Control and the Science and Practice of Low-Carb, High-Fat Eating. It's 8:13. Well, Utah's chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics has launched a new online resource to help parents and caregivers navigate the challenges of the COVID-19 pandemic. Carolyn Murray has this report as part of our ongoing coverage of early childhood health and wellness.
COVIDparenting.org is a pandemic coping guide for parents. It provides support and information for parents and healthcare providers as families navigate the uncharted waters of isolation, anxiety, and illness brought on by COVID-19. Dr. Spencer Merrick is a triple board resident and the COVIDparenting.org liaison to the Utah chapter of the American Academy of Pediatrics. He is a pediatric general psychiatry and child and adolescent psychiatry resident. He says the pandemic has presented a unique challenge to good child care.
And so it kind of was born out of recognizing organically a need for this and a need for resources for parents who don't know where to look for how to establish a schedule when your routine is so disrupted, and where to turn for help and how to look for warning signs of when your kid is getting sick. Midsummer, kind of a collaborative effort between myself and some other residents in my program and some attending physicians got together and started to put together resources, and the resources just kept piling in and getting more and more organized in such a way that we thought this is bigger than what we set out to do. And we created an entire website that is dedicated to really doing the basics, creating structure and helping to manage that stress and getting help.
Merrick says there is an uptick in children's general anxiety across the board, even with kids who seem to be coping well.
There are still challenges that we see even in those kids that seem to be coping well because their routine's disrupted and they're sleeping differently, they're eating differently, they're isolating in ways that they don't realize, and they're managing screen time differently. So even the kids that seem to be thriving end up having a few things that come up. But definitely we see this hit kids that are in lower income groups harder.
He says children in lower income families are hit harder due to both parents working often more than one job and unable to provide supervision and support. Merrick says stress from parents trickles down to younger children, and due to social distancing, lack of play dates, and general stress, early childhood language development is affected. Behavioral issues also can surface.
And so when a kid isn't getting socialization through daycare, finding ways to maximize that social contact for their language development and for their social development through other means, if that's just extra Zoom calls with grandpa or or dedicating time to play with siblings and people in the own household, things like that. But we do see a lot of people coming into clinics struggling with some behavioral concerns with their younger kids.
The project was funded by a grant from the American Academy of Pediatrics and the Georgetown Center for Children and Families. He says well-child visits, routine vaccinations, recommended screenings, and follow-up care is important to do during the pandemic. The resources provided on the website refer to Utah services, but they plan to make the website more universal and share it with the other AAP chapters. COVIDparenting.org officially launched last week. Merrick says he is thrilled the vaccine is rolling out to the public, but he says it is not time for parents or anyone to let down their guard.
I want to stress that we're still in for what will likely be a difficult winter, that getting the vaccine does not mean masks off right away, that we're still in for a little bit more of a long haul, and these resources will be tremendously helpful for people that are struggling, which is all of us to some degree or another.
You can find a link to the parenting resource on kpcw.org. Carolyn Murray, KPCW News.
It's 8:18. Good morning. Summit County Councilmember Kim Carson served two terms in office before deciding to retire. She'll be replaced on the County Council by Melina Stevens. Kim joins me now on the phone for her final interview as a council member. Good morning, Kim.
Good morning, Leslie.
So any regrets or are you excited to do something different?
No, I don't have any regrets. Serving on council has been just one of the greatest honors, truly. And I believe in term limits and I practice those. I did so with school board and with this. You know, there's so much you want to continue doing and things that are unfinished. But it's time for some new perspectives on council. And I'm just really excited to have Melina in that role. So I look forward to seeing what the future brings.
Yeah, we often hear from elected officials that there should not be term limits because that's what elections are for. So interesting that you've kind of implemented your own set of term limits then, huh?
I guess so.
Yeah. Talk briefly just about how the two offices differ from school board to county council.
I think I had a lot more direct contact with staff when I was on the school board. At that point, for part of my time on school board, the school board representatives selected people to be directly involved with contract negotiations, and I was involved in a lot of different trainings that were also attended by staff. So I think I got to know them a lot better. Since we don't spend a whole lot of time in Colville, we have our meetings there, but we don't have any dedicated offices there. We primarily work out of our homes. I do have limited contact, but, you know, the staff at the county is amazing, and they make the rest of us look good. You know, we come up with our goals, and it's just... I just really appreciate the hard work of the staff throughout the county in helping us achieve those goals.
Yeah. So looking back, I mean, what was your most gratifying accomplishment, you think, on county council?
You know, I figured you were going to ask me that. And even though with some a little pre-thought, I don't have a great answer for you because, you know, there's so many things. I guess I would say I served as the liaison to the Board of Health. And the work we did around behavioral health was incredibly rewarding. We were not doing a good job, basically, serving the mental health needs of a lot of our constituents. And we were one of the only counties that, I mean, we couldn't find any other evidence of a county going in and doing an extensive behavioral health or mental wellness review, or you know, we went in and did quite a deep dive and did a lot of surveys, and it really was a thorough assessment, and it showed a lot of deficiencies. So we were able to, you know, work with state groups, like the state board of the health directors, board of health members from across the state, and then, of course, the State Department of Health and their behavioral health division. And, you know, I think some of the ideas that we've come up with here will actually, I think eventually we'll see some of those implemented across the state.
Well, in addition to improving the mental wellness services, county also kind of took on the issue of vaping. How do you think that the health board did with that?
Well, the health board was really quite, we went as far as we could, I'll say, but the state legislature has some pretty strict statutes that they developed around that. So we're limited on what we can actually do on a local basis, but it'll be an area we'll continue to focus on. Yeah, the numbers, you know, and I don't have those right at the tip of my tongue, but I know that the number of youth that we had that are in, probably still do, that are vaping within the community just skyrocketed over the last few years. So we're working hard on education and limiting access to those, to that young population when we can.
Yeah. Also, we had an issue with opioids. Did the county make the right decision getting involved in this humongous lawsuit?
I think we did. Yeah. And I think, you know, Margaret Olson is intimately involved in that. And I think counties across the state, or not just across the state, but across the country, getting involved have brought the pressure that's needed to be able to make a difference in the outcomes. And I think I'm certain that eventually we'll get some funding that'll enable us to improve programs around opioid education and hopefully recovery for those that are addicted.
Yeah. And then, of course, the health board has spent enormous amount of time this year dealing with the unprecedented pandemic. I mean, how did we do there?
It was not how I planned or anybody planned this year. I think that we reacted swiftly, and I think it, you know, it was just tough because nobody knew anything about this virus. And it's tough when you're working in a vacuum like that. So, I mean, we had daily meetings where we would discuss everything from the most recent research that they were finding to local numbers, state numbers, national numbers, how the tourism industry was impacting our community, how just behavioral patterns on the east side were affecting numbers over there, how we could best communicate. I know we'll look back on it and say, you know, we could have done this differently. But I think overall, taking the actions that we took initially up front, the actions of our community to, for the most part, be very compliant with wearing masks. And I know that there's exceptions to that in pockets where it's not being done, but, you know, research has clearly shown that wearing masks and social distancing makes a difference. And I think that's why you have people walking around on Main Street this week. And, you know, our numbers spiked up again over the last month. It appears that we have a bit of a decline, and we had really high numbers in the county surrounding us. And so we knew that eventually that was going to affect us because we have so many people from those counties that work in Summit County, that come and shop and play in Summit County. And I think that played out over the last couple of weeks. But, you know, we're seeing hopefully the start of a decline. And then, you know, I'm sure we'll expect one after another spike after the Christmas holiday. But there, I would just really encourage people to continue to wear your masks, social distancing, and then limit your numbers.
We're speaking with outgoing Summit County Council Member Kim Carson. We've been reporting on an accident there on the Mine Road. It's mile marker 3, according to Park City Police Captain Phil Kirk. It was a fatal crash. Utah Highway Patrol is the primary responder, so we'll need to get in for more information from them. But the news is that the road will be closed for the next 3 to 4 hours. So if you are thinking to heading on to Empire Pass, you will not be able to get through there. Kim, I'm back to kind of some of the just the look back over the last 8 years. Can you talk about your most difficult decision?
Oh, you know, I think I really agonize over every decision. We've had, you know, some land use appeals where we really had to fall back on the legal aspects of it on those. Might not have been the outcome we wanted, but we just had to do what we could do from a legal standpoint. Approvals of developments. We haven't done many new developments since I have been on council, and I know people may say, now, wait a minute, we've seen a lot of growth in building, but a lot of those approvals came actually before I was on council. So what we were working with and approving was the actual development agreements that put into place what was originally granted as far as allowed density and uses. So those were always challenging. I think the Eastern Summit County changes to we did an update of the general plan, which went pretty smoothly, but the Eastern Summit County development code update that we did, you know, that was really almost a 6-year process from the start of the planning commission's work to then going into the council's work and review and public hearings. And you know, I think we got to a point with Eastern Summit County residents, you know, not everybody was happy. Some people thought we didn't give enough opportunity for a new development, and others felt like, you know, this is going to completely change Eastern Summit County. So it's trying to find that balance between, you know, maintaining the lifestyle we all want and being able to accommodate growth so our families can stay. So that was probably one of the most challenging.
Okay. And finally, just wanted to ask you, so what's next for you? I mean, how are you going to spend your Wednesdays?
You know, I don't have any specific plans at this point. I'm still very interested in our transition to regional transit through the changes we've made to our transit ordinance with the Centerville Basin Transit District. So I may pursue, you know, staying involved in some manner there. There's a lot of local nonprofits that, I mean, there's so many in town that do so many incredible things. But, you know, I'd like to get more directly involved on that level. I've got, you know, everybody talks about all the closets they cleaned during COVID. I haven't cleaned many closets. This has been the busiest year that I've ever had on council between COVID and then Hideout. It was just a very challenging year. So I look forward to relaxing, traveling once we're able to do so. I mean, there's always a lot of camping we can do to still keep our socially distant recreation, and but I do look forward to those things. And I just have to go back to thanking the community for their support of me over the years. I've received some of the kindest notes over the last month that just really mean the world to me. And the staff, again, I put them up against any county staff in the state. They're just outstanding and help us get things done. And then, of course, to my family, they made a lot of sacrifices over the years. And so I just really appreciate their support. And I love them.
Okay. Well, I know I'm joined by many, Kim, to thank you for your years of service. So hope to see you around. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Leslie. And I thank KPCW for always helping us get the word out.
You bet. That's outgoing County Council member from Summit County, Kim Carson. You're listening to Local News Hour on KPCW. Well, the People's Health Clinic and Summit County Health Department is asking members of the community with healthcare background to register as a volunteer to distribute the COVID-19 vaccine once it becomes available. On the phone with more details about the Medical Reserve Corp, I have the director of the People's Health Clinic, Beth Armstrong, along with Summit County Nursing Director Derek Moss. Okay, good morning to both of you here.
Good morning.
Derek, let's start
with... Good morning, Leslie.
Let's start with you. Have you replaced then Carolyn Rose, who retired?
I did, yes. Those big shoes to fill. She's done a great job for Summit County.
All right, well, congratulations on that. So you've been with Summit County for a while?
I have. I came over from... I was working over with the Sheriff's Department prior to being here.
Great. Well, tell us about the Medical Reserve Corps. I mean, is this something new or something that's just being formed now?
No, this is something that's been in existence in different counties for a while. Luckily, we haven't needed it very frequently. This is a list of volunteers who are willing to step up in times of need to help out in any kind of a disaster or medical situation such as we find ourselves in now.
Yeah, so who are you looking for in particular?
Any medical professional that's willing. I mean, there's really a great need across the board, from nurses to doctors, MAs, medical assistants, even certified nursing assistants, CNAs, would be beneficial. Really, any medical professional, we'd love to get on our rosters so that if the need arises that we could... have a resource list that we can contact.
All right. And Beth, if somebody wants to help but doesn't have that medical training, can you put them to work?
We have.
Absolutely.
I'm keeping a running list right now. We have about, I would say, 30 volunteer medical providers, as Derek just said, just somebody that falls into one of those three or four categories. And then we have a larger number of non-medical providers, people in town that really want to be able to step in and assist. I think because of the different days we're going to do it, what we want to do is not have any volunteer more than a day, not volunteer 2 days in a row. So we would set people up for shifts on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, or Tuesday, Thursday, and then we're going to set them up in 4-hour shifts so no one's standing in our sheltered area, even though it'll be, it's not going to be enclosed, but it will be sheltered. It's still going to be cold because it will be winter still. We just want to make sure they stay comfortable. So this leads us to need a larger number than we think we needed. So yeah, we'll take, at this point, our greatest need is the medical personnel because they're the only ones that will be doing the actual injections. And they have to be currently hold a license in their specialties. So those are the only people that will actually be doing the injections, but we'll need people to be flag waivers to, for directional, for traffic, people to sign the folks in as they're coming through. We might even need some people that can do data sorting and, being able to people get onto the system that maybe aren't able to do that from their home. So there's a pretty good need. We're having a great outpour of interest, though. So I think we're going to be fine.
Okay. So, Derek, where will these vaccination shelters be set up?
So we're kind of stepping up depending on the amount of vaccine that we're getting. And these initial clinics we're going to start over at the Utah Film Studio has been generous enough to allow us to hold some medium-sized, I'm calling them, clinics there. Once the vaccine supply into our county increases and we're able to for lack of a better word, outgrow that facility, then we're looking at a couple options right now, just to looking at the logistics, especially with the weather. So we really haven't identified a permanent place yet that we're ready to announce. We have a pretty good idea, but we're looking at a few spaces across the county.
All right. Before we talk a little bit more about that rollout of the vaccine, tell people how they can become a volunteer in the Medical Reserve Corps if they're interested.
Absolutely. The best way is actually to contact Beth right now. and Beth, I'll let you go ahead and give her. She's going to be our volunteer coordinator for this effort through our Emergency Operations Center. And so she's going to be the caretaker of that list. So I'll let Beth give her how she is best contacted.
Right. Thank you. For right now, it's working really well. If people want to just email me directly, letting me know that they have a desire to assist in this effort. Again, we think that it's going to be over at least a month. So I don't think that we can have too many volunteers, and they can just email me at my email address here at the clinic, which is my first name, Beth, B-E-T-H, at phcpc.org, and that's People's Health Clinic, Park City, so phcpc.org. And I will respond. I put people on the list. All I really need is their names, their phone numbers. Obviously, I'll have their address. And then if they're an RN or an MD, it'd be nice to have their licensure number on that email. And then whenever we know more about timing, we will reach out with an email to our volunteers, and we'll have for them to go in and actually go in through a computer program and schedule what days they want to, you know, help us. So there will be, they can do just one day, or they can do every day, every other day of the week. So that email will be forthcoming. But for right now, we're just keeping that log of all volunteers.
All right. Derek, can you talk a little bit about the rollout of the vaccine here? Of course, we're inoculating the first responders, the folks there at the hospital. We also have the priority schedule of those 75 and older. So we're out at the couple of homes that Summit County has for older people, giving them vaccinations as well. Then what?
Yeah, so we're following really closely the CDC and state recommendations related to the priority groups. And this phase really is focused on employment types. So like you were saying, you know, really focusing on hospital workers, specifically those that are most exposed to people or potential patients that have COVID. And that was the first wave, and that's finishing up or has finished, depending on, you know, the hospital across the state. And they're still working on that. Last I talked to here at the Park City Hospital. That's the first wave. The second wave inside this first phase finishes up with the rest of the hospital workers, and it rolls out into the community for the non-hospital healthcare workers. And so these can be anything in our county, from our clinics, dental offices, pharmacies, you know, anybody that's in the course of their occupation is exposed to people that could potentially be sick. They're coming in for different medical services, things of that nature. So they've been identified as a potential higher risk. The other one is, like you're saying, the long-term care facilities. And we do have a couple of those in our county, and those are being actually handled by the state. They have a company called CNS that's going to come around and help those guys get their vaccines. And then the last part of this second wave is the frontline public. And so these are people who are going to be helping us with these mass vaccination clinics. These are people who, again, through the course of their normal occupation, are really at a higher risk for being, you know, having this virus transmitted. And so that's the second phase. And really the speed at which we're able to go through this phase is determined by the amount of vaccine which we're being sent from the state. And we've requested as much as we can, but just the supply to the state hasn't been as much as we were hoping, and therefore the, you know, the trickle down into our county hasn't been as high as we were hoping. But we do plan on giving it out as quickly as we can. We've started some small trials right now just to test our process, test our software, and make sure that we're ready to go. And I do believe we are. We have another small test coming up, and then at that point, we're going to really step up and move over into that Utah Film Studio clinic space.
Okay.
And for now, we're planning on twice a week, 2 days a week, that we'll be supplying those vaccines, and then we'll be contacting each of these clinics individually. We've been working with the Chamber of Commerce to help identify, and make sure that we're not missing anybody as we roll this out. We're trying to be very systematic in the way we're doing it.
Okay, so they need to wait for you, you know, rather than the other way around.
No, I mean, I don't mind if they reach out. We've had a significant amount of people who've reached out just to want to make sure that they haven't been missed. We're trying very hard to make sure that doesn't happen. So I don't mind a phone call or an email here and there. Just to make sure, but we are actively, we've got an entire group that is just working on trying to identify each clinic that would qualify for this wave two.
Okay, but then they'll get notice to say you can come on Tuesday at 2 o'clock or something? Is that how it's going to work? How do they know when to show up?
So what I do is I'll contact the point of contact at that clinic. And we give them, you know, work with them to identify all their employees that would qualify. Then they get uploaded into a system that the CDC has created just for this vaccine effort. That system's called VAMS. Once they're uploaded to VAMS, they get an email with a link so they can go in, fill out their medical questionnaire and their pre-vaccination questionnaire ahead of time, as well as they can then see any available time slot and they can sign up.
Okay.
So it's at their convenience.
All right. And then what about teachers? Are they going to be able to get the vaccine while they're on holiday break before they have to go back to school?
So the teachers, it's completely independent of supply, but we have a fantastic group of school nurses. So I'm working with them as well as the superintendents. And then as soon as we get the vaccine for the teachers, we're going to actually administer them directly, so they won't have to come into these clinics. Their school nurses will be able to work with their staff and handle that.
Okay, that could be like the week they get back then, perhaps, huh?
The sooner the better, in my opinion. But again, unfortunately, that supply of vaccine is completely out of our hands.
Right.
But we're watching it closely, and we're in communication. Yeah, unfortunately, I wish I had an answer for that as to how soon it could happen. But I do anticipate it is actually coming very soon.
Okay, and it'll be done at school then for the teachers. And then
that's the current plan, and that's the last I talked to the superintendents and the school nurses. That was the plan, so I believe that's still the plan.
All right, and then the rest of us, they're low on the totem pole. I mean, do we just wait our turn? Are you going to give us numbers? I mean, how do we know?
So on that, we're adjusting that right now. So originally, that first phase is what we've talked about so far. The second phase, originally it was still focused a bit on employment type, but more on living conditions. So any kind of a congregate living facilities, homeless shelters, you know, it kind of went based on that. So just recently they changed that to the age-based, and thereby, I think, a little bit more accurately, the risk-based populations. And so we're actually having many meetings right now to try to figure out exactly how that works, how we're going to get the word out to those populations and get them enrolled, such as that. So that's still a new change directive that came down to us, and so we're trying to adjust to that now. So I'm not exactly sure at this time how that's going to look. I hope to have an answer for that within the next week or so.
Okay. Well, we'll have more later then. I appreciate your time today. Thank you.
Absolutely. Anytime.
That's Summit County Health Department Nursing Director Derek Morris, along with People's Health Clinic Executive Director Beth Armstrong. Well, due to winter's onslaught of cold and flu, and then on top of an already stretched thin staff due to COVID-19 illness and quarantine, the Park City School District has contracted with EduStaff to help provide needed backup. On the phone with me, I have Raymond Massey. He's EduStaff's National Development Team Director. Good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Happy to be here. Thank you so much.
Yeah. So are you based here in Utah?
So EduStaff
I've been in an organization for 10 years, and with every school district that we partner with, we actually put recruiters on site to assist with district needs. So our organization is actually based out of the Western Michigan area, but we partner with over 500 school districts across 9 states. And like I said, in each one of those states, we have a presence.
Okay, so what is it that your company does and what you provide for? Is it only school districts or for any organization?
Good question. So EduStaff is built right into the name, educational staffing. So our clientele is school districts. And what EduStaff does is we hire, train, and manage substitute teachers for partnering school districts. We have found this has been a very helpful tool for several school districts looking to free up their HR departments, make them a little more efficient, and allowing EduStaff to handle the day-to-day needs when it comes to the needs of substitute teachers for the school district, as well as long-term needs.
Okay, so only teachers, though. You don't help with the shortage of bus drivers.
Correct. We were not contracted with Park City School District to provide for them bus drivers.
All right. So how difficult is it to recruit during this, during a pandemic?
It's a great question. So COVID has changed a lot of things. It's important to remember that due to COVID-19, it has affected every single school district nationally differently. It's increased the need for substitute teachers in many cases. A lot of districts that we're partnering with are actually calling for cohort models. This request has increased rapidly, where they have a small number of individuals in each building that they rely upon daily to handle the needs of the substitute teacher. And we know that with teachers who were also relying upon the day-to-day needs of giving their children to school, with COVID-19, this has changed. Some of those teachers, men and women both, have been pulled out of the classroom and are now taking care of their child's needs as, you know, the significant other goes to work or does what they need to do. And so it has really changed up a whole lot in that the request for substitute teachers has actually increased. And we as an organization actually anticipated this increase prior to it really hitting. And so we upped our advertising and marketing efforts a little bit earlier in the season this year to try and offset that need as much as we could.
Yeah, and I guess I'm just wondering, how is it that you find teachers when the school district, which has decades of doing it on their own, can't do it? I mean, what is it that you're doing that the district hasn't already done?
That's a great question. So when districts call upon EduStaff to help provide for them substitute teachers, we are both recognizing that there are some things that are just going to be evident in the landscape of education today. Number one, there is a national shortage of teachers. This is no secret. Every HR director that you speak to across the country can attest to this. We know that the education departments and colleges are shrinking. In some cases, they are actually closing and shutting down. And then fewer individuals are actually getting into the classroom to teach. And so this has caused, in the public school sector, I don't want to say a panic, because I don't think that the HR directors are panicking, but I do think it has made them aware that the individuals that were coming into the classroom and substitute teaching before are going to be a little different than what they were in the past. And so I said that to say this. EduStaff actually, we partner with the Hanover Research Group out of the Virginia area, D.C. area. And we actually created a study for our subs in Michigan, where we are at, located. And we interviewed several through the survey. We're able to get some good answers from the surveys we conducted. We did a longitudinal study that actually followed a group of individuals from the application process all the way to actually taking a job. And then we just did a survey. And we had, I believe, over 1,000 people in the survey, and what we found in the survey was very fascinating. We found that the average age of a substitute, in Michigan anyway, was a 45-year-old woman, college-educated, looking to get back into the workforce. And I'm certain that if any school district, you know, decided to take part in any sort of survey, they would see that the motivating factors for people getting to the classroom are going to be different. So this really forced us to kind of approach it from a different perspective, in that we had to figure out, okay, who our clientele is, and then how to gear our training and materials to that individual who may not be well-versed in the classroom. So in addition to the training that we offer for substitute teachers, realizing that not only that there's a shortage, but that there are different people coming into the classroom, we also leverage our marketing and recruiting efforts as much as we possibly can. So I'll open up the interview basically telling you that we have a recruiter on site there in the district. Now, right now, due to COVID-19, of course, they are working remotely, but they are right there in Utah and will be working daily on the front and back end to fill absence.
Yeah.
And so when an absence is created, our recruiter, the evening before, is actually sending emails and informing the greater subpool that, hey, these jobs are created. Be sure to take these jobs. They are available for you to take. And then the morning of, they are actually sending text messages and making phone calls to these individuals. This frees up those secretaries and the staff in the building from having to do that work, right? It allows them to focus on the day-to-day needs of their students, of their staff, and allows ed staff to kind of do that heavy lifting piece for them.
Yeah. How many?
We also have recruitment. Oh, go ahead.
I'm running out of time here. So how many subs does Park City School District need on any given day?
It's really going to depend on that need. Some days are better than others. Some seasons are better than others. So as you get closer to the warmer weather, and as more teachers, maybe take some time off, the increase will go up. Near the start of the school year, it's not that heavy because all teachers are on deck. So it really just, it fluctuates.
Yeah.
It's not a static number. It's very dynamic.
Are we talking about 5 or are we talking about 50? Somewhere in between.
Again, it could be somewhere in between. It just depends on the needs of the district. Our job is just to make sure that we are at the ready, that when those absences are created in that system, that our recruiter is doing everything that they can to fill those absences for the district the evening before and the morning of.
Okay. What are your company's requirements for those who may be interested in becoming a sub? In about 30 seconds.
Great question. Yeah. So we follow exactly what Park City is required to do within the confines of Utah law. They need a minimum of a high school diploma or GED. They need to provide proof or documentation of that. There's a fingerprinting background check process. There's an assessment screening process test. We don't let just anyone walk in the door and teach. Of course, there's a condition disclosure, and they'll have to fill out an application. They attend a workshop virtually, of course, and then they submit all their documentation digitally, which is actually helping our recruiters help with that process to get them into the system. And then once they're approved to work, they are then able to accept jobs through the Smart Find Express system.
Okay, what's the per diem pay on that for a sub?
Yeah, great question. So a non-licensed sub is at $106 per day. A licensed teacher is at $123 a day. Now, if they are in a long-term position, those rates will increase. At a long-term position, non-licensed, they are $123 a day, but a long-term licensed teacher at $140 a day.
Okay. Hey, I've got to leave it there. I sure appreciate your time, though, Raymond. KPCW News Time now, 8:59. You've been listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. It's 9 degrees again, looking for mostly sunny skies today, with highs again into the mid-20s.